From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Two setbacks for the White House this morning. A federal appeals court has ruled that President Trump's financial records must be turned over to House Democrats who've subpoenaed them from his accounting firm.
And former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Marie Yovanovitch arrived for closed-door testimony in the House impeachment inquiry, which centers on President Trump's request that Ukraine's president investigate his political rival, Joe Biden. President Trump's political rival, Joe Biden. Let's bring in our politics roundtable this Friday. Margaret Tolove, Axios Politics and White House editor. Hi, Margaret.
Hey, guys. Good morning.
Hello. And Kimberly Atkins, WBUR senior news correspondent. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi there.
So let's start with Yovanovitch, who is testifying today on Capitol Hill. Even though the White House has said that it's not going to cooperate with this inquiry, they didn't block her. This morning, we also learned that Ambassador Gordon Sondland will testify next week about texts that he exchanged about withholding military aid to Ukraine in exchange for political help. His testimony was blocked by the White House before. Kimberly, what do you make of the fact that the Yovanovitch testimony at least went ahead today?
Yeah, I mean, it really shows that these efforts by the White House and the State Department to really put the brakes on this and basically stonewall, much the same way that we saw happen during the Mueller investigation, those efforts just aren't working this time. I think that the court case that you mentioned, too, is just sort of a triple blow that really is making this White House aware that this inquiry is very different, that the people involved are taking it more seriously.
But they could have blocked her if they wanted, right? I mean, if the White House said today, you can't testify, they could have done that.
She is still, the ambassador is still an employee of the State Department. Mm-hmm. So technically, yes, there was a directive from the State Department to not have anybody cooperate. But she still moved forward. Look, these are people who also themselves could face some repercussions from
right.
not cooperating with this investigation, too. So for them to move forward, in this case, it was a private interview. It is not a deposition or anything like that. But in this case, it's probably a calculation was made that it's better to go in and talk to members of Congress in this closed door session than to try to block or stonewall, which could lead to further action and more involvement of the courts, which is something that they're probably trying to avoid.
Just quickly, Margaret, does the same apply to Gordon Sondland? Because he was blocked, and now is he just completely defying the White House? What are the repercussions for him? Is he breaking any laws by doing this? I don't understand yet.
Yeah, these are two really interesting kind of bookends to this, right? I mean, you've got with Marie Yovanovitch, you've got a career Foreign Service officer who, by all accounts, had a long reputation for anti-corruption crusading, and the expectation is that she would be able to shed some light on what must have been her discomfort with Rudy Giuliani's increasing sort of like side door involvement of all this. With Gordon Sondland, you see a completely different figure. He's the U.S. ambassador to the EU, not a career Foreign Service officer at all. In fact, a hotelier who was a mega donor to President Trump, which is not an uncommon way as a bundler or a major donor to become an ambassador. That's common in both administrations. But nonetheless, not a lot of policy or even political experience. And the EU is not the Ukraine, but there was a special decision made by the Trump administration to make the Ukraine part of his purview, even though it's not part of the EU. And of course, he's in those text messages. So they come at this from very different perspectives. Originally, he was told not to testify, but our reporting, my colleague Elena Treen and I, our reporting shows that many Republicans have urged the White House, look, if Yovanovitch is going to be out there, put Gordon Sondland out there as soon as you can, because he is much more likely, as we can see on the texts, to paint a sympathetic picture of the president's intentions and to defend the president's actions.
More loyal to President Trump, apparently. Let's talk about some other big news involving the impeachment inquiry. Yesterday, two associates of President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, were charged with campaign finance violations. They were arrested, connected to their work to undermine Ambassador Yovanovitch for Giuliani, who was working in Ukraine for Trump. It gets very complicated here. But then there was this statement yesterday from President Trump.
I don't know those gentlemen. Now, it's possible I have a picture with them because I have a picture with everybody. I have a picture with everybody here. But somebody said there may be a picture or something where at a fundraiser or somewhere.
By the way, there is a picture of President Trump with them and Rudy Giuliani. But Richard Painter, who's the White House ethics lawyer in the George W. Bush administration, likened the Giuliani associates being arrested to the Watergate burglars, which, of course, was the beginning of the end for President Nixon. Kimberly, is the White House worried?
They should be. I mean, we've seen, I mean, first, with respect to the president's reaction, recall that his once campaign chairman, once he got into trouble, President Trump tried to minimize the fact that he even was involved in his campaign. So this reaction is very Manafort-esque. So that's not really surprising. But yes, these are two people who were working very closely with Giuliani, by Giuliani's own admission, who he brought in an effort to try to, in this broader scheme, and to try to get information from the Ukraine on Joe Biden. And now they've been arrested. This certainly should put Rudy Giuliani in some peril, as he too, they were arrested at Dulles Airport on their way to try to fly to
Vienna. After having lunch with Rudy Giuliani.
Lunch with Rudy Giuliani, and subsequent reporting was that Rudy Giuliani was headed to Vienna before this happened as well. He's very closely connected to this. There was also the response from the letter from John Dowd that came out earlier this week that connected Rudy Giuliani to these two individuals. Mm. So they are connected by any number of ways, and are really bringing this directly into the White House in terms of their connection to all of this. So all of this was very bad news for the White House, for Giuliani himself, and certainly for the president.
I think the early part of this controversy was about whether the president was trying to mobilize or leverage his foreign relationships with foreign leaders to put pressure on Joe Biden or expose either expose nasty information about Biden's son, or else at least trigger quote-unquote investigations to suggest that there was nasty information. This development with Rudy Giuliani and the Ukrainian businessman takes things in an expanded direction, because it goes to the question of whether or not this was also about making money, about business dealings. And it's not necessarily one over the other. It's the question of both. And for Democrats, the strategic decision they may need to make in the coming days or weeks is whether they want to keep a very tight focus on Ukraine only, and or the Trump-Biden thing only, or whether it's going to expand as a result of some of this information that comes
forward. Democrats have said all along they liked this Ukrainian story in the sense that it was easy to explain. But it's getting more and more complicated every day. Now, Margaret, staying with you, the president is going to need Republicans in order to get through this crisis. And a lot of vulnerable Senate Republicans are getting grilled about their position here. Here's Cory Gardner of Colorado, asked whether it was appropriate for a president to ask a foreign leader to investigate a rival. Yes or no was the question he was posed. Here's what he said.
Well, look, this is what we're going to get into. The Senate Intelligence Committee is having an investigation, a bipartisan investigation. Unfortunately, though, what we've seen is a very political process take over. If you look at what Al Green in Texas, member of Congress, has said, we need to impeach President Trump now because we might not be able to beat him in November. That's about politics. That's not what the serious investigation should be about.
But is it appropriate?
Joe, I've answered your question.
No, you didn't.
A lot of senators will not answer the question yes or no. They've got to be under a tremendous amount of pressure, and it's not going away.
Yeah, certainly. And Axios did this, actually, like, if I can blow toot our own horn for a minute, this amazing graphic within the last week or so about President Trump's red wall and just how difficult it would be to breach that wall in terms of if the House did vote to impeach, how very difficult it would be for this Senate, this current Senate, to convict. Nonetheless, having said that, I think the developments in Syria, with President Trump giving the green light by pulling the U.S. troops out of northeastern Syria, giving the green light for Turkey to go forward with what has now become an operation that's killed many civilians among the Kurds, who were the U.S. allies and partners in the ISIS fight. That has been a bit of a breach. You've seen many Republicans who have been absolutely opposed to this Ukraine impeachment inquiry go after the president on his dealings with Syria.
Well actually, Margaret, let's listen to one of them, because this is really interesting. This is retiring Congressman Jim Shimkus of Illinois, the first Republican to say he's cutting ties with Trump completely over Syria. Here he is on KMOX.
I'm heartbroken. In fact, I called my chief of staff in D.C. I said, pull my name off the I support Donald Trump list. I mean, this was just, we have just stabbed our allies in the back. The Kurds go back all the way to the first Gulf War. This has just shocked, embarrassed, and angered me.
So, Kimberly, finally, on that note, what about Republicans who are standing up to the president on this but not on Ukraine and impeachment?
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it was really puzzling, the timing of this. The president clearly sees the idea of pulling troops out of the Middle East. He thinks that that's him fulfilling a campaign promise, and he thinks it's important for him to do before the election. But as we've discussed, it really fractured his support among Republicans on this issue. Now, whether that translates into broader skepticism about the issue of impeachment and the attempts at seeking information from Ukraine officials, that remains to be seen. I think a lot of people next week, when Congress comes back into session, will be looking at people like Mitt Romney, someone who comes from a very popular place.
And we're going to have to leave it right there. Kimberly Atkins and Margaret Tolliff, thanks to both of you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, one of the hosts of On Point, the NPR show that takes you behind the headlines. We've done a deep dive series on education, and all episodes are available to binge now. Listen to On Point now on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Lebanese band Mashrou Leila has been called the Arab world's most popular indie pop group. They're currently on tour in North America with stops in New York and Washington, D.C. this weekend. Mashrou Leila got its start at the American University of Beirut in 2008, 2 years before the anti-government protests known as the Arab Spring. They supported those protests and have been outspoken ever since. The lead singer and lyricist, Hamed Sino, is openly gay. In the Arab world, that is taboo, if not illegal. The band's new album is called The Beirut School. This is the song Radio Romance. Well, joining us now, our lead singer, Hamed Sino. Welcome to you.
Hi, thank you.
And the drummer, Carl Georges, is with us as well. Welcome to you.
Hello.
Okay, so I have to start by the fact that you've been banned in Egypt and Jordan, protested, threatened. Why?
I guess at this point in the Middle East, it doesn't really take much to get banned, as you can see from what's happening with protests around the region. Anyone sort of articulating anything about freedom of speech or basic human rights in the region gets heavily opposed by political bodies.
And was that about you being openly gay or about the message of your music?
I don't think it's exclusively about me being openly queer. I think it's more about our position about the uprisings across the Arab world to date and how our audience has situated us amongst those protests.
And how does that play out to be banned in a place like that?
What do you mean?
I mean, do they call you up and say you're now banned, or how does that work?
No, you tend to find out about it through the press. Actually, it's much more violent.
And actual concerts get canceled. You know, so we had a concert in Jordan, and the concert was canceled. And then we received statements, you know, official statements signed by ministers and by political figures.
In Lebanon, what happened was that, you know, the concert, we haven't been banned in Lebanon. We just had our last concert canceled very, very violently. And the way that played out was entirely through like a media war, basically.
What happened?
What happened is that our work was taken out of context and sort of perverted in a way that that was rather unfortunate. People were taking some of the lyrics out of context and trying to make it look like the band was sort of out to arbitrarily blaspheme and offend the Christian faith in particular, which isn't really our agenda, to be honest.
Fake news and fake pictures and fake videos were produced, you know, massively. They edited, you know, parts of interviews we did from all over the world, and they did overdubs, and it's like...
It was actually pretty hilarious.
A huge, huge production, you know.
What is your agenda?
Honestly, we just want to make music. And, you know, the politics are an integral part of who we are as people. So it tends, you know, these things tend to sort of surface in the lyrics and in our positions publicly. We're very, you know, vocal feminists. We, you know, tend to be very supportive of the uprisings across the Arab world. We believe in democracy. We believe in gender justice and in sexual freedoms and in social justice in general when it comes to, you know, sort of race and class. And that apparently makes us Satanists and Freemasons, according to the Arab press.
I want to listen to one of your songs. This is Cavalry. This is your first English language song.
Best stop brandishing that sword of yours, lest you fall right off of your throne. If I fail, if I die, I'll come back every time till I've seen you through. Ooh, every head you cut turns into three. I burst into armies of me.
Now, in a video for this song, you show Arab children in what seems to be a real-life encounter arguing with Israeli soldiers. What is the song about? And tell us more about the video as well.
So the song is something that we wrote after getting banned in Egypt. And the song is really just about sort of self-empowerment and knowing that there are certain fights that you're bound to lose but that you show up for anyway because of what that means for a longer struggle. Interestingly enough, the video isn't, you know, sort of explicitly about Arab children and an Israeli army. That's why the director sort of chose to go with more neutral military outfits that don't actually resemble the Israeli army's uniforms. Mm. The video is really just about sort of the militarization of politics and what it means for oppressive politics to start to sediment into every aspect of our existence at this point, not just in the Arab world, around the world in general, I think.
Let's listen to another song. This is Salam, which means peace, of course. Here it is. So let me say, first of all, you have a beautiful voice.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tell me about this song.
So this song, we got invited to be part of this workshop organized by Block 9 at the Banksy Hotel in Palestine. And because of the political situation between Israel and Lebanon, and essentially those two countries still being formally at war, we're not actually allowed to go to Palestine because that would mean having to get our passport stamped by the Israeli government. So we ended up Skyping in to this workshop with Brian Eno and Roisin Murphy and, you know, Black Madonna and many other artists that we adore. And wrote that song with Roisin Murphy. And the song is basically, you know, just about really wanting to be able to see Palestine, especially given that Palestine has been, you know, this almost mythological place at this point that we grew up hearing about. And that's been the basis of so much of Lebanese politics for forever. And just not being able to see that and longing to see that place.
When you talk about the politics in the Middle East and now you're touring around North America, how does it feel in this country, given the politics of the moment here?
Honestly, it feels eerily similar. You know, it's horrible seeing that the whole world is very much moving to a similar drum right now. What's going on here is pretty crazy, and it's been very disappointing to me personally as a Lebanese-American citizen to sort of move here and be confronted with the fact that that sort of myth of American exceptionalism and American advancement when it comes to social justice and race equality and gender equality and sexual freedoms is very much just a media myth that isn't really there on the ground. And that was heart-wrenching for me.
What about you, Carl? How do you feel touring around the U.S. at the moment?
For me, I'm a bit more positive than Hamid because I don't live here, actually. I'm based in Beirut, so to me, it's quite exciting to be here, you know. And we started the tour in Dartmouth. We played in a cottage, so, and we had a talk with the students and we gave courses. Those people were interested, actually, in what's happening in the Middle East. They were, like, passionate and asking thousands of questions. So it shows that there is a beacon of hope.
let's listen to a song that NPR actually called a song of the summer a couple of years ago. This is the song called Roman. So, Hamid, this is a feminist anthem?
Inadvertently, yes.
What's the message in it?
The song itself is really just about betrayal, and we wanted to shoot a video for it, and a friend of ours, Jasim Salim, decided that she wanted to situate the site of that betrayal within patriarchy. And obviously, you know, the four of us got super excited about the opportunity to be allies and what that means, about sort of amplifying someone else's politics through our platform.
When you listen to that song, and that's a couple of years old now, how do you think your sound has evolved?
Interesting enough, that song is much older than 2 years. We actually wrote it like 6 or 7 years ago and sort of just put it in the drawer. It's changed a billion times. At some point it sounded like a metal track. At some point it sounded like an indie rock track. Huh. Right now I have no idea what it sounds like. The production is pretty barren and sensual, I think. How do I think our sound has changed? I think, you know, from the get-go we've try to avoid being bogged down by one genre or one aesthetic as much as possible. We're very easily bored and we consume all sorts of music. And I think that sort of comes out in the tracks.
The band is called Mashru Leila. The singer there we've been speaking with is Hamid Sino and the drummer Carl Gerges. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much for having us.
If you're in New York or Washington, you can find more information about Mashru Leila's performances this weekend at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
Today, the Nobel Committee announced that the Nobel Peace Prize is being awarded to Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed for his efforts in resolving the 2-decade border conflict with neighboring Eritrea last year. Here's his response to the news.
This is a great news for Africa, the place where peace is a very expensive commodity, and I'm sure it will give us energy to realize peace in our region.
Says, I'm sure it'll give us energy to realize peace in our region. Joining us now, NPR East Africa correspondent Eder Peralta, who's in Washington today. Hi, Eder.
Hey, Jeremy.
And some people may not know about this 20-year-long border conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea. More than 80,000 people died. First of all, why were these two nations at war?
So this was a fight between brothers and sisters. In the 90s, Eritrean separatists helped Ethiopian rebels topple the communist regime. But in return, the ruling party allowed Eritreans to vote on independence. But that really turned sour very quickly. An agreement in 2000 ended the heavy fighting. But border disputes just continued over years. About, you know, who should have this town, who should not have this town. And it was basically an intra-party fight, relations gone sour. And it was a cold war for many, many years until Abiy ended it.
And tell us how he did that. This is Abiy Ahmed, the Ethiopian prime minister. He's only been in office for a little more than a year. How did he manage to broker peace on the border so swiftly?
I mean, in some ways, he just declared it. When he came into power, he flew to Eritrea to talk to Isaias Afwerki, who's the president of Eritrea, and he somehow convinced Afwerki to fly to Ethiopia. And he did, and he was welcomed in Addis Ababa, the capital, as a hero. And it was just astounding. The phone lines that had been dead all of a sudden came alive. And I traveled to the border between Ethiopia and Eritrea, and these borders that had been militarized for very long, the Ethiopian army pulled out. They were open. I met some families who walked through minefields to get to see family members who hadn't seen each other in decades. And, you know, I think one of the things to note about this is that this prize is not just about peace with Eritrea. It's also about what Abiy has done in Ethiopia. And he has truly transformed this country, which was once one of the most repressive in the world. And when he came into power, things changed dramatically. I'll give you an example. Before Abiy, I would go into Eritrea, and it was always, I would go into Ethiopia, and it was always under the guise of the African Union, that I was covering the African Union. Hmm. Most of my interviews had to be done in secret. And people, they were really scared to talk. And suddenly after Abiy, it was like as if Ethiopia was breathing again. People could talk freely. The opposition was able to operate freely. But this is a bittersweet moment for Ethiopia because Abiy's tenure has also been marred by violence. There have been assassination attempts against him. There has been coup attempts against him. Their defense secretary was assassinated. Mm-hmm. So I just spoke to an Ethiopian political analyst who says that this gives Abiy another chance.
It's NPR East Africa correspondent Eder Peralta on today's Nobel Peace Prize, which is going to Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Eder, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
More than 100,000 people in Southern California's San Fernando Valley are under evacuation orders today as the Saddle Ridge Fire burns out of control. Here and now's Tanya Mosley is at the scene of the command center right outside of Sylmar. That is the northernmost neighborhood of Los Angeles. Tanya, welcome. What are you seeing?
Hey, Peter. Well, I'll tell you, as we drove up here, we saw flames in the air and lots of smoke, and we were about 20 or 30 miles away from the center of the fire. But I think more importantly, what we're feeling is the wind, and you probably can hear that 25-mile-an-hour wind, sometimes hitting as high as 50 miles an hour, and the humidity is really low. This fire is about 4,700 acres wide and climbing, and it's 0% contained right now.
Low humidity, high winds, recipe for fire. As I said, 100,000 people under evacuation today. What more do we know about how and where this fire started?
So it really started late last night. I'm going to say about 9 p.m. last night, and Los Angeles firefighters received this call that there was a brush fire right off of Highway 210. Once they got there, they saw that it had immediately overtaken several homes. 23,000 residences have been evacuated, and as you said, that's about 100,000 people. There are four shelters that have been opened. Several of them are already to capacity. L.A. Fire Chief Ralph Terezas, he says that there are about 1,000 firefighters out here fighting this fire. They're in for the long haul. They expect to be here all weekend. And he has this message for residents.
This is a very dynamic fire. The public can help us by listening to police officers and firefighter directions, especially when we're talking about evacuations. Do not wait to leave. If we ask you to evacuate, please evacuate.
So, Tanya, how complicated is that evacuation? Because I know that several roads, major freeways, are shut down in the area.
Yes, they were able to get lots of people out. As I mentioned, all four of those shelters are almost to capacity. But they're asking folks, if you are in the area, you need to leave. Several of those highways really are preventing people from coming into the area. So they're asking people, just stay home, don't go to work. Several schools are closed. Santa Clarita is an area that is under threat, and they're asking folks in that area to evacuate. And also the schools are closed there as well.
Okay, the big picture here, of course, is that that we've been reporting all week on PG&E. This is California's largest utility, and its decision to shut off power to over 2 million customers to preemptively stop wildfires
right.
from happening. But I understand that PG&E does not cover the region where you are. Do you know if the utility there would shut off the power?
So, yes. Yeah, so where we are, the L.A. Department of Water and Power services this area, and they cut off power to help in the firefighting efforts. But there is several fires that are burning to the south of us. The Sandalwood Fire, about 70 miles east of L.A., and also another fire about 20 miles from the center of L.A. And Southern Edison is the facility that actually gives power to that area, and they have preemptively cut power to about 2,300 folks there.
I spoke yesterday to a state senator who was concerned about those outages across the state, and yes, people have been seriously inconvenienced, but, you know, Tanya, looking forward, and in light of these new fires today, what are people saying about all this?
You know, cutting power is one of the simpler things to do. It is very much an inconvenience, but when we're talking about these high Santa Ana winds, I mean, they are gusting. All it takes is the embers to just kind of hit some of the dry patches, and we could see a massive fire like we're seeing here.
That's Here and Now's Tanya Mosley at the scene of the Saddle Ridge Fire in northern Los Angeles. Tanya, thanks so much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you.
And earlier this week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said President Trump was not above the law and that he would be held accountable after the White House refused to cooperate with the House impeachment inquiry. Pelosi is at the center of the political drama that's currently playing out over allegations that the president used his position to pressure a foreign leader for dirt on a political opponent. As Marissa Lagos from member station KQED reports, the San Francisco Democrat's role is no surprise to people who know her.
Before she was second in line to the presidency, before she was one of the most recognizable political figures in the country, Nancy Pelosi learned how to cut deals and keep friends at the knee of her father, Thomas D'Alessandro Jr., a congressman and mayor of Baltimore.
She was born into this very politically operational family, and she's always been that way. That's why she's risen to the heights she's risen to.
Former San Francisco Chronicle reporter Mark Sandalo wrote a biography on Pelosi. He and others say in some ways, Pelosi's whole life and career have been in preparation for this moment, a confrontation with a bombastic president over allegations of corruption. Those allegations came to light because of a whistleblower complaint made possible by a law she helped write as a member of the House Intelligence Committee. Sandalo notes, Pelosi has been receiving high-level intelligence briefings for a quarter century.
Pelosi can certainly run rings around the president when it comes to understanding, you know, the ways in which intelligence works in Washington, and that's got to be an advantage in this fight.
To the chagrin of many on the left, the speaker has taken a long time to get here on impeachment. And even though she represents one of the most liberal districts in the nation, Pelosi waited until the most moderate members of her caucus were on board.
What is so remarkable about Nancy Pelosi is her grit.
San Mateo Congresswoman Jackie Speier came out for impeachment this spring, but says it makes sense that Pelosi waited. That's because Democrats who prevailed in swing districts in 2018 tipped the scales for Democrats in the House. Without them, Pelosi wouldn't be Speaker.
She has taken a lot of slings and arrows from our very progressive Bay Area for over a year now. And she's held the line because she instinctively knew that she had to get to a position where it wasn't just 50 or 100 or 150 members supporting impeachment.
That number now stands at more than 200. Pelosi's daughter, Christine Pelosi, says her mom understands the value of consensus. One reason she's kept control of the fractious Democratic caucus for a staggering 17 years.
And even when she's not whipping a vote, she's always counting. And she has to make sure that people are ready to go when they're ready to go. Because she's liberal, she knows the value of people being able to move out in front of her.
That was the case here when Pelosi waited until an avalanche of support for impeachment erupted from the more centrist factions of her caucus. That included seven members with national security backgrounds who laid out the case for impeachment in an op-ed. Sandalo says that seemed to change the winds.
Nancy Pelosi is very pragmatic. She would not go forward with this unless she had a firm belief that there was evidence existing to impeach the president, unless she thought there were Democratic votes behind her to impeach the president.
That may be true, says Republican National Committee woman Harmeet Dhillon. But Dhillon, a San Francisco lawyer, still thinks Pelosi made a huge mistake by backing impeachment. Until now, Dhillon says, she's been impressed by Pelosi's ability to curb what Dhillon calls a purely partisan effort.
I think that the way that she sort of quickly flipped into pro-impeachment on the word of Adam Schiff selling her and her party a bill of goods was a foolish and catastrophic mistake that I think she's going to regret.
Dhillon is referring to Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff, a Los Angeles Democrat who Dhillon and other Republicans see as among the far-left members driving impeachment. She says the impeachment inquiry is coming at the cost of Democrats' political and policy agenda.
All of the things that they care about have been left by the wayside in this partisan witch hunt, and I think that has been a big political mistake, possibly the biggest political mistake I've seen Nancy Pelosi make in the close to 20 years I've been here in the Bay Area as a Republican.
Dhillon says she hopes Pelosi pushes the entire House to take an impeachment vote in the coming months. She's betting it will be a bad move for Democratic members who won swing districts in 2018. But Christine Pelosi argues that her mother excels at chaotic times like this, and not just because of her decades in politics, but because of lessons learned while raising five children born within 6 years of one another.
The more wild and frenetic things get around her, the calmer she is.
And Nancy Pelosi may need that serenity in the months ahead. For Here and Now, I'm Marisa Lagos in San Francisco.
South Park aired its 300th episode this week on Comedy Central, and it is as controversial as ever, upsetting China this time. Over its 22-year history, South Park has skewered politicians, religion, celebrities, small-town America. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has been watching it all, and he joins us now. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Okay, so let's talk about the most recent South Park controversy, because they have made an enemy out of the Chinese government. China banned them for an episode last week, and they had a scene in this week's episode which seemed to be a response. A character named Randy, who made a fortune selling marijuana to China, is confronted by his business partner, who doesn't want to be in business with the Chinese.
Wait, Tally, come on, I need you!
I'm never working for a company that's regulated by a communist government!
Okay. No more selling to the Chinese.
Then say it. Say the Chinese government.
Chinese government.
I didn't hear you.
The Chinese government. There.
Okay. Eric, explain this controversy to us.
Now, first, we got to point out that this guy was talking to
Tally.
A sentient towel.
Right. Tally.
Tally.
Yep.
So, South Park actually got in trouble with the Chinese government last week for an episode that they did called Band, B-A-N-D, in China. And it was about the South Park kids forming a band and deciding to do a biopic about themselves and then having the content that they were going to put in the biopic affected by whether or not they thought the Chinese government would get upset. And the whole episode was a big satire of how big corporations, especially Disney, would curb the materials in their films and TV shows in order to avoid offending the Chinese government so they could have access to that market. Mm-hmm. So they got in trouble. That aired. Chinese government scrubbed a lot of their material from the internet in China. And then this episode that aired this week, their 300th episode, had that scene that we just listened to. Now, they may have planned that, but the way they produce the South Park episodes, it's possible for them to insert something like that. I really hope that's what happened.
Well, and it's very interesting, especially coming at the time when we're talking about the NBA and China and trying to balance the idea of, free speech versus keeping this very, very big market happy. They've also gotten into politics in other ways, including in this week's episode, which dove headfirst into anti-vaccination conspiracy theories.
No, I don't have to get my shots ever. And they can't do anything about it because I'm a consciousness objector.
A conscientious objector?
Yeah, I told the school, I said, look, you guys, I happen to have religious, moral, or philosophical convictions. And I said, I believe that health and disease should not be controlled by vaccination. Those are my beliefs.
So, what I love about South Park is that they look for the hypocrisy in American society, wherever it lies, and then they just mercilessly make fun of it. Mm-hmm. At any one moment, they might be making fun of anti-vaxxers, as we just heard, or they might be making fun of hypocrites in Hollywood, or they might be making fun of the Church of Scientology. They've done all those things. And then they'll turn around and make fun of something that liberals like. And so the show just has a very keen eye for figuring out where is the hypocrisy in pop culture, in American society, and how can they bring it to the world of these very foul-mouthed fourth graders in mm-hmm. In Colorado. And it has worked sort of astonishingly for 300 episodes and 22 years.
Well, and one of my favorite things that they did, just to your point, to make fun of gentrification in this country, is they named a neighborhood Soto Sopa, south of downtown South Park, which I thought was hilarious. But on a more serious note, Eric, I watched an episode the other day in which they took aim at the Trump administration. One of the main characters, has been around for a long time, Cartman, gets Kyle detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Here's the scene where ICE agents take a roll call of children behind bars.
Pavlovsky, is that an El Salvadorian name?
No, I'm Jewish.
What? How did a Jew get in here?
I'm just here because some fat, intolerant didn't want me around.
Yeah, that's why I'm here, too.
Yeah, me too.
Yo, boy, we gotta get this kid out of here. People might think we're racist.
Eric, pretty pointed commentary there.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, what South Park excels at is sort of finding the hypocrisy and blowing it up. So, you know, we're having these discussions about immigrants, and some people are pretending that the kind of language that they use and the kind of tactics that they use, mm-hmm. you can see how in history they've been racist, they've been prejudiced. And the same people who are advocating treating immigrants a certain way would never advocate treating Jewish people that way. When you look at the history of the show, people like Norman Lear have helped write episodes. Hmm. People like Bill Hader. It's a really interesting process that they have developed over the decades to create this show. And considering how it started, it blows my mind that it's still around and that they're still managing to stick their finger in the eyes of hypocritical situations.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.